Stand by for action.
Battle stations. Battle stations. Anything can happen in the next 60 minutes with Andy Kershaw.
Five. Four. Three. Two. One. Thunderbirds are go.
Thunderbird, Stingray, and Captain Scarlet. Some of the best-looked TV programs ever made. As popular today with the digital generation as they were with the parents a quarter of a century ago. The creator, Gerry Anderson, suggests their enduring appeal, as with all great ideas, lies in simplicity.
I would say to the writers, the first stage is to take a character and devote, say, 10 minutes... to getting to like him or her and caring about him or her. Then, in some way, put them in terrible jeopardy. Now spend the rest of the show getting them out of that jeopardy, but working against the clock, having set a time, which was goodbye time. And then in the closing moments of the show, almost count down the seconds, like 10 seconds left, and literally the last moment, save them. And so that was the simple formula.
Well, there's still time. We got a whole day before...
Before we melt to nothing. Why doesn't Earth do something?
Solar module from International Rescue. Do you read me?
Now I'm hearing things. I thought that was the radio.
Come in, Solar Module. This is International Rescue.
It is the radio.
Solar Module to Thunderbird 3. Where are you? Can you help us?
We hope so. We're going to try to fire your retros from space.
Operating safety beam now.
Negative. We're 4 hours short.
4 hours?
But that means we'll have to go much closer to the sun than was estimated.
It looks like it.
Can we stand the increased heat and radiation?
On paper, no. But we can't just abandon those three guys. We sure have a problem.
Why, in your opinion, do the Gerry Anderson creations, from Supercars to Thunderbirds, all of them, have such enduring appeal?
I wish I knew, because then I'd make sure that I always did the same thing on the new series I'm going to make. I mean, I can only guess. And, of course, one of the things is that the shows, as you know, were all set in the future. And so, for instance, just as an example, when the shows were first made, microphones were the size of tennis balls. And we could see that things were going to get smaller and smaller, so we went way ahead and made what in those days was quite ridiculous-sized microphones. And suddenly today, they're about right. So the technology is reasonably acceptable. The stars haven't aged. If the good guys are against the bad guys. And, of course, the shows... they're very expensive. I mean, you know, if they were made today, you'd be talking about £300,000 a half hour. Well, I mean, that sort of money's not spent on kiddies' programs.
Does it work on a number of levels, you think, as well? I mean, there's straightforward sort of adventure and family entertainment. But are there other factors at play as well?
Well, when you talk about a number of levels, I mean, I can tell you... very definitely, that all the shows were scripted on two levels. I mean, I've got a boy of 8.5 right now, and there's no question about it. He controls the television set, and I think kiddies always have done. And so I made up my mind that I would have the things written on two levels so that the kiddies could enjoy it, and every now and again there would be something in it that would go straight over the kids' head. And that the parents would enjoy. I mean, you know, when Parker's down the pub And he talks about taking her ladyship a nightly cup of cocoa up to her bedroom. I mean, you know, that sort of thing, I think makes it more tolerable for the parents.
Ah, Parker, how are you progressing?
Oh, very well, milady. I'm keeping well up to schedule.
Well, I shall be retiring for the night now, Parker.
Very good, milady. I trust you have everything you require.
Well, I must admit, I miss my usual cup of cocoa.
I did anticipate that, milady. So I slipped an up flask of your favorite brand in the foot of your hat box.
Thank you, Parker. Good night, then.
Good night, milady.
Don't tell her ladyship, but I'm doing a bit of chauffeuring on the side. And I've got this handy Kershaw geezer in the back. Sounds like a right criminal. We're on our way to a Fanderson convention held in an hotel in the middle of the Watford bypass. I'm doing a bit of modelling there myself, actually. See you inside.
The biographer of Gerry Anderson, and also the author of the book Fab Facts about Thunderbirds, is Simon Archer. Hello,
hey,
Simon.
Nice to meet you.
And you.
Well, here we are in the dealer room, where probably you've got a few memories coming forward from your childhood. Some of the old toys, comics, annuals, all sorts.
I can see a lot of stuff my mother threw out when I was about 12.
If only you knew what it's worth today.
Let's find out.
Over here we've got some of the older merchandise.
So these are originals from the 60s. There's a Thunderbird 3 there, the orange Rocky.
That's right. Now these were made by Gerry Anderson's merchandising company, Century 21, in the 60s. And of course very, very collectible now. If you've got, say, this Thunderbird 3, this plastic version, and it's in mint condition and boxed, then it's probably worth...
Well, let's ask the dealer.
Ask the man himself.
What's your name?
I'm Patrick Duffy.
Patrick, I'm Andy.
Hello, nice to meet you.
So you've got a couple of Thunderbird 3s sitting there, primed and ready to take off on your store. How much are they?
Well, this one here is not in too good condition, that's 12, but the one that's in better condition, that's 15.
Well, if you've got one that's still in the box, I know they're always more valuable if you've got the original packaging.
If you're lucky to have one that's in mint condition and it's the original box, you're talking about anything up to £60.
Wow.
So they're quite expensive.
I think somewhere in my mother's attic, I've probably still got a collection of Thunderbird bubblegum cards.
Yeah.
They do such a thing. I'm sure still there. Oh, would there something like the 1970 England World Cup? What would they be worth?
Well,
that's the ones.
They're the colour ones, yeah, they're the Sompatex ones. They're worth about, if they're completely in mint condition, anything up to £150 now. So, if you let me come round, we'll have a look and sort something out.
Perhaps it's time to revisit my mother.
Yeah.
Well, what have you got here, Simon?
Now, these are the comics that were produced again by Gerry Anderson's company back in the 60s.
TV21.
Yep. 1965
by sevenpence.
That's right, it broke the sixpence barrier, which was quite something. But this comic, together with the Lady Penelope sister comic, had a weekly circulation of about 1.25 million copies, and that still hasn't been beaten to this day. Full colour stories throughout, and some of these stories appear in today's Thunderbirds comic. And it followed everything from Supercar, Stingray, Thunderbirds, Captain Scarlet, Joe 90, the lot. And this comic, it was produced in a newspaper format. That's something that the creator asked for from day one, which is quite different. So there'd be big banner headlines.
This one is Ghost Ship Haunted. This is the story in this edition. 1965, although the date is printed as 2065. Tempest near to death. The hunt for the ghost ship, believed to be manned by hostile undersea aliens, is nearing its conclusion. This was the report received earlier this morning from Commander Shaw, who is at present aboard Stingray. However, the commander could not disguise the tremor in his voice when asked about Captain Troy Tempest. The last time he was seen, said Shaw, was when he boarded the galleon alone. I am very worried.
Yeah, it's time.
moment, what have you found?
Remember these? These were the discs that were produced again by Jerry Anson's company with the stories, some of the stories from the shows put onto record.
This one's an LP. I remember some EPs.
That's right. Again, very, very collectible. Anything up to about £40-45 today.
Well, you're some EPs, Ed.
Yeah.
Marina Speaks from Stingray. Because she never spoke. At last, hear the voice of the mysterious and beautiful Marina. And why she may never speak again.
Marina, aqua Marina, what are these strange enchantments that start whenever you're
the characters.
They were a third life size, about 22 inches high.
Ah. What's happened to them? The original puppets, do they still exist? I thought they might be all sort of lined up here when we walked in.
Many of the original puppets were destroyed, or just thrown out, but some were kept. But
who survived?
Carano from Thunderbirds. Troy Tempest from Stingray was found earlier this year, alive and well, living in St. Albans. But a lot of the models went into a big skip at the back of the studios because they needed the space, and so they were thrown out.
Oh, that's terrible.
And then kids living on the estate at the back would nip over the fence and, with the permission of the studios, would go and take the stuff out.
Well, where was this?
In Slough.
Oh, yeah.
It was on a new factory, a new industrial estate, just a few yards away from the chocolate factory. And if even if you go there today, there's still the smell of Mars bars, which they had to put up with.
Well, let's get back to civilization. Work out the location of that shaft, will you?
Troy, I can't. All the instruments have been shattered.
How about the sound scanner? Is it working? That's our last hope.
It's working, Troy, but the scanner just shows the impulse bouncing off the bottom of the Earth's crust.
Keep at it, Phones. We've got to find that shaft.
Oh, this is hopeless, Troy.
We've got to keep trying. It's all we can do. The air's running out.
I know how Troy and Bones felt. Getting away from the floor of Space City, in this case, a hotel on the Watford bypass, was just as difficult. I left Parker to polish the rolls and slipped off in search of one of the key people involved in Jerry Anderson's super marionation.
Banville was a puppet maker, operator, and supervisor on every Anderson series, from The Adventures of Twizzle through to Thunderbirds and Terrorhawks. Christine, what was The Adventures of Twizzle? I don't think I'm old enough to remember that one.
Oh, well, it went back quite a long time. And it was about a boy who had arms that he could twizzle, and legs that could twizzle out. And that was his gimmick, so that he could be very tall, his arms could lengthen and retract. It was kind of a weird idea, really.
When was this, mid-50s?
Well, I think we started the 57, and the following one was a series called Torchy, and that did in fact have a rocket in it.
Torch, he was the battery boy, wasn't
he? Yes, and he had this torch bulb in his head, which you could see through walls and this sort of thing with this. I think this might well have been the first of the space fictions because of the this rocket that he used to travel in.
Was that the secret of Gerry Anderson's success, do you think? He caught the mood of the times in the sort of mania for anything to do with outer space and space travel.
I think it was, because you see, in those days they couldn't make space fiction series with people. The special effects were just too involved. You could do it with puppets. So the next step seemed to be to take the puppets into space, and in fact they could do it better than if they had actors.
I wish I was a spaceman, the fastest guy alive. I'd fly you round the universe in Fireball XL5. Way out in space together, conquerors of the sky. My heart would be a fireball, a fireball. Every time I gaze into your starry eyes, we take the path to Jupiter, and maybe very soon we cruise along the Milky Way and land upon the moon. To a wonderland of stardust, we'd zoom our way to Mars. My heart would be a fireball. Cause you would be my Venus of the stars.
You based some of your puppets on real life actors,
yes.
Didn't you? Who?
Scott Tracy was based on Sean Connery, who was the young, handsome hero at the time. Couldn't wait to get my hands on him. Then, yes, we did. I made Titan. In my own mind, I thought Laurence Olivier. So there's this green-faced puppet with the kind of Laurence Olivier eyelid. Quite good looking for a villain.
And Troy Tempest was James Garner.
Yes, that's right.
And did you have a number of puppets for the same character? I'd be rather disappointed if you tell me that there were several Troy Tempests and several Parkers. And
oh, well, there were. Well, what started this off was in Fireball XL5, Venus had a very smiling, affable face, and she went through hell sometimes on these adventures, smiling her way through it. Gerry said, you know, that's not right. They should look a bit anxious sometimes. So we had a frowning head, blinking heads, because they did have to sleep sometimes, and these two normal heads, for one for each stage.
Oh, hi, Venus. Say, who've you got there?
This is Danny Denver. Danny, meet Colonel Steve Zodiac of the World Space Patrol. Gee, Steve Zodiac.
Hello, Danny. Come in, won't you?
Matt, this is Danny.
Say, this is a real pleasure.
And for me, Professor. Well, what I really want to know is how space travel all began. And how are we going to put a man on the moon?
Say, I wonder if we could relive that first flight.
How do you mean, Steve?
Well, Matt has the sounds on tape, and we know the countdown checks and the type of rocket used.
That's a great idea. It'll be just as though Danny is flying with us to the moon. And we can explain everything on the way.
Okay, Matt. You get your tape sorted out, and then we can start.
Maybe Danny would like to hear some more Fireball music while you're doing that, Matt. Gee, I sure would. Say, could I hear some of that other Fireball music, too?
Why not? But first, we'll have to turn the record over.
Hey,
learn some great outtakes where things went wrong.
Oh, yes. Well, I think there always are, aren't there? I mean, puppets that are sitting quite sort of relaxed in a chair and the head swings off. That sort of thing.
Do any of these survive?
I hope not.
Did he have some sort of problem in making them walk properly? I mean, if anybody wants to convey the idea of Thunderbirds to another person these days, all you have to do that rather stiff, wobbly side-to-side walk. Was it difficult to make them move?
Well, making a puppet walk anyway, even if it's a stage puppet, is the most difficult thing to do. We haven't done it successfully yet. But some of the puppets were permanently lame, like Sam Shaw. And he was in a kind of super wheelchair thing, you know, that one puppet less that they could sort of move from one place to another. And then there was these kind of motorbike things that they had. That was another method. Then later on they had moving walkways where the puppets just stood and sort of went along a moving walkway. But those were all devices to get over this inability to make the puppets walk.
What's about relations between the characters? I've heard rumours of romance between Lady Penelope and some of the others. Is this true?
Well, yeah, I've heard those rumours as well. There might well have been something between her and Jeff Tracy, but I mean, there's nothing that would hinder the International Rescue Organisation. But also, there was a titled man in London that she seemed rather fond of, but I always suspected her and Parker.
Well, I'm waiting for your explanation, Parker.
I seem to have lost my way, m'lady.
Lost your way to London?
Yes, ma'am.
Step outside, Parker. I want a word with you. Now, why are you so intent on stopping Lord Silton getting to the bank, Parker?
Me? M'lady?
Yes, you. I can see now that it was you who put the video phone out of action. Now, suppose you explain, Parker, I'm waiting.
You got a right dressing down there, I can tell you. And I have to say that there's never been anything untoward between me and her ladyship. I always have had a soft spot for Lil, the cook back home. Anyway, I'm ferrying fingers, Handy Kershaw, back to Pinewood Studios to talk to a Mr. Henderson, who happens to be a big wheel in the film industry. Always fancied being in films myself, but I never quite made it.
Were you aware when you were making them that you were in the process of creating some of the best-loved programmes in the history of television? Did it feel that monumental?
Well, it certainly felt monumental, but not in the sense that you mean. The shows were extremely difficult to make. I mean, trying to make sort of action pictures for kids with marionettes, which are basically cripples to begin with. I mean, it really has to be the most difficult job in the film business that I can think of.
At that point, why? Puppets? I mean, if you wrote it down on paper and you said, well, here's the proposal, I'm going to create this big action-adventure series with puppets, and everything's got to be scaled down, and we're going to have people upon gantries above operating, why not just use real actors?
Well, of course, I mean, you know, the answer is you would be locked up, wouldn't you? Sort of to read such a brief and then make them with marionettes. Briefly, what happened was I'd been in the film business. I started life as a sound editor on movies. And then, like a lot of young people, I decided that I would form my own company. And, I mean, what do you need to form a company? You need a typewriter, filing cabinet, telephone, and an office. And you sit there and wait for all the orders to come in. Well, of course, nothing came in. And we were on the point of bankruptcy when a writer by the name of Roberta Lee arrived at the studio with 52 15-minute scripts entitled The Adventures of Twizzle. And she said, would you like to make these? And I mean, the answer was yes. Had they have been pictures about crocodiles or lice, we would have said yes, we were pretty desperate. And then she said, they're to be made with puppets. Well, I mean, I'd never seen a puppet in my life. And they certainly didn't appeal to me, I can tell you. And all that happened was that we started to make these puppet films. The puppets were dreadful. And I would meet friends, you know, from the film business who would say, hi, Jerry, what are you doing now? And I would say, I'm making horror films. Making what? Puppet films. And I was thoroughly ashamed of this. And so I thought, quite wrongly, that if I made the puppet film look really respectable, and if I made them look really super, then the broadcasters would take the films and say, hey, this guy can really make real pictures. And then they would give me something like a Spielberg picture to make. But of course, the reality was they looked at the films and said, doesn't he make good puppet films? Let's get him to make some more.
In Four Feather Falls, Four Feather Falls, there's always magic in the air. In Four Feather Falls, Four Feather Falls, you'll always find a vacant chair. In Four Feather Falls, Four Feather Falls, where every heart is kind and true. If ever you're in town, they'll never let you down. Stranger, there's a welcome for you. But anything can happen, anything at all. You might hear a dog meow. Hey, hey, but stranger than that, any stray cat may suddenly remark, bow wow. Oh, ho, Four Feather Falls, Four Feather Falls, the only place on earth to be. 'Cause Four Feather Falls, Four Feather Falls, is heaven on the range to me.
Then we made our first, the first show that we financed and created ourselves, which was a puppet western called Four Feather Falls. And that, in fact, did very, very well. It was made for Granada. We delivered all the pictures to them. We got the front cover of the TV Times. Everybody liked the show. And I'd never heard from Granada to this day. I mean, I expected they would order some more, but nothing happened, and consequently, after a few months, we were about to go bankrupt, when somebody said, there's a guy by the name of Lou Grade, and you really ought to go and see him, which I did, and it turned my life around.
Supercar, supercar. Beauty and grace, fast as can be, watch it flying through the air. It travels in space or under the sea, and it can journey anywhere. Supercar, supercar. It travels on land or roams the skies, through the heavens mighty rays. It's luxury man, and everyone cries, it's the marvel of the age.
You know, Dr. Beaker, I think that piece of music's great. It reminds me of all the adventures we've had together in Supercar.
Yes, Jimmy. I know how you feel. It has exactly the same effect on me.
Dr. Beaker, I've been sitting here all morning trying to figure out what this big steel box is you're working on.
Well, Jimmy, I've been keeping it a secret. But as I've completed my work, and am about to carry out the first test, I'll tell you.
Gee, Dr. Beaker, it sounds exciting. But what is it?
A time machine, Jimmy.
Dr. Beaker.
Dr. Beaker.
Dr. Beaker. Listen, Dr. Beaker. How voices.
How voices.
They're kind of funny. Kind of
funny.
Gee, Dr. Beaker, I think you're the greatest scientist in the whole world.
As these kinds of programs were without precedent, where did you find the experts in the field to help you if there wasn't a field beforehand?
Well, there were no experts, and I think a typical example is we had a young lad by the name of Derek Meddings, who initially came into the studio in the evenings to paint cloud backgrounds for us. Then as the company became bigger, he joined us. And we were filming a supercar, and we had a character called Dr. Beaker. And we had a sequence where Dr. Beaker was playing an organ, and he got sort of so carried away with the music that the organ fell to pieces. And Derek Meddings said to me, do you think it would be a good idea if he blew it up instead of it collapsing? And I said, well, how are you going to do that? And he said, well, I reckon if I buy some fireworks, I can make a sort of an explosion, which he did. And it went off with such a hell of a bang that the puppeteer overhead jumped, and that caused Dr. Beaker to throw his hands up in the air. And we got this wonderful shot. And so, you know, it then started, Derek, can you do this? Derek, can you do that? And then, of course, Derek opened his own special effects department within the studio. And, of course, today he's world-famous Academy Award winner.
There is, I understand, a very real danger that the entire building could collapse at any moment. We will be on the air again as soon as we have...
Almighty explosions were fundamental to a good Thunderbirds yarn. Derek Meddings, who pioneered blowing things up, was also a designer of the futuristic craft of the Anderson series. Imagine being the bloke who invented Thunderbird 2.
All the large departmental stores that had a kitchen section, we used to go round and sort out bags and bags of these various items like calendars and some unusual sort of teapot. Having collected all these things, we'd go back to the studio, chop the handles off, chop the spout off, and use the center part. And then we used to buy hundreds of plastic kits, Monogram, Airfix, and all the kits that were made at Revel. And we used to sort amongst all the pieces and take out the pieces that we knew you couldn't really afford to make. And then with a lot of design going into it, we used to add these pieces and stick them on. We used to use a lot of squeezy bottles and plastic containers, and we would stick it and maybe make one part, like we might make the cockpit, or we would find a cockpit from a larger kit, and then we would build on this plastic bottle or whatever it was. And having stuck all the bits on, then we'd give it a spray of grey so that it brought it all into one colour, so that you couldn't see it had fairy liquid on it and disturb your eye. And then we would look at it, and then we'd either add more or take pieces off. And then having agreed that it was a good shape, then we would paint lines on it and separate areas so that it looked as if there were panelling, and then dirty it down. And in the end, of course, we had some very, very good craft.
Well, brains, your phenomenal mind made all this possible. Now you're going to see it in operation.
Well, good luck, Scott.
Take it easy, Scott.
I think there was a conscious effort to make the science fiction aspect as believable as possible. And that really means that you have to take situations that people understand and put them into a science fiction backing. But I'm forever saying to people that you have to relate to what people understand. I mean, if I pick up that Coke tin and start talking into it, I mean, you think I've gone off my rocker. And if I then said, no, this is a futuristic telephone, I mean, you can't stop a show and say, folks, This is a futuristic telephone. It may not look like one, but that's what it is. And this is a pencil. I mean, everything has to be recognizable. And so I think in the same way, so do situations. And we had at the time Radio Caroline, so everybody knew what pirate radio was and meant. Take that, put it into space, and you had science fiction, but science fiction that people would readily understand.